Welcome. This is Pastor Bob DeWay from Twin City Fellowship, and I'm also the author of Critical Issues Commentary. Today, I'm interviewing Brian Flynn, who wrote a book entitled Running Against the Wind, and the subtitle is The Transformation of a New Age Medium and His Warnings to the Church. Brian and I did a series about my book in which he interviewed me, so now we're going to do it the other way around. I'm going to be the host, and Brian, who's with us, is going to share as we kind of work our way through his book and ask him some questions. But before we do this, I want to let you know how to contact us. This is Critical Issues Commentary, the radio ministry of Twin City Fellowship, and you can find us on the web at cicministry.org or twincityfellowship.com. Thanks for joining us. Welcome, Brian.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. This is great.
Well, I'm excited to ask you some of the details about your book and your story and how you ended up in the New Age and so on. And your book starts out by telling about your Catholic upbringing. Why don't you share with us a little bit what it was like growing up Catholic in New York State, whatever decade that was?
Yeah, it was a decade long, long ago. I didn't really understand a lot about what Catholicism was. I think my impression of church was really what was given to me by my family. My mom never went to church with us because she was Episcopalian. So the agreement was when they got married that they would raise the kids Catholic. So I was the youngest of three, and my impression was that you went to church on Sunday, and that was something that you were supposed to do. Most of my friends were Catholic. I grew up in a neighborhood where many were Italian, and of course, almost all of them were universally Catholic. But the one thing, in looking back at that, my impression of Christianity wasn't necessarily Catholic per se, but it was just a way of life in which you showed up to church on Sunday, but God really wasn't much a part of your life the rest of the week. It was obligatory.
Okay.
It was an identity. Just like I might say, well, you know, my family is mostly Irish and Scottish on my dad's side. So it was more like that type of an identity. That I'm Irish. Well, I'm Catholic.
So you're obligated to be Catholic.
Yeah. I didn't understand what it meant to be a Christian and a follower of Jesus Christ. I knew the story probably more by watching television programs about the whole story than I did out of the service.
Really?
Usually the service to me, and again, this is all that I knew. You went to church. It was a darkened atmosphere. The priest would say something, you would repeat it back, he'd say something, you repeat it back.
Was it in English at that time?
It was in English. Now, okay. When my brother, who was older, when he went, it was in Latin.
Okay.
And I don't know how in the world you'd ever understand any of that, but that was one of the reasons that my dad started to have doubts in the church, because they started changing things, you know, in the early 60s due to Vatican II, and one of them was that they were no longer going to have the service in Latin. In fact, my brother, he took Latin in high school so that he could better understand the service.
Wow.
So by the time it got to me, they were no longer doing that. But I don't think I remember anything relevant that was ever said during the service that made me think. Now, obviously, you know, I went to church up until the time I was 10, but it more or less seemed to be you went through a series of rituals that you witnessed. You know, the priest would break the bread. He would go through these certain motions, of which I didn't know if they had any significance or not. And then the one thing I remember is that everybody got lined up to get, you know, the Eucharist, or at that time was some cookie to me. And and then I knew that once that was over, there was only about 10 minutes left in the service, and I could be free for the rest of the day. Because to me, church was just a chore. It wasn't something I looked forward to, or really knew what it was supposed to mean.
Now, I think you mentioned that at a certain time you got First Communion, that was a big deal.
Yeah, I went. Now, at that time, you normally made it, I only remember it, not by age, but you're supposed to make it when you're in about second grade, and I was 2 years late, so I was the only fourth grader in the class, and I, again, had very little knowledge of what it all meant. It was just supposed to mean that when you went through this process of going to the priest, you know, you went in your little booth, you told him your sin for the week, And I went in, I didn't even know what I'd done wrong. I couldn't even think of anything. I really had to make something up. And I went, well, I argued with my sister last week. Okay, well, say three Hail Marys and then you're done. Well, I didn't even know how to do the Hail Mary thing. I didn't know the Hail Mary prayer. To this day, I still don't know. So I went up and I was supposed to go up in front of the front of the church and then pray Hail Mary. And all that I knew was Hail Mary, full of grace, blah, blah, blah. That's all I knew of it. So that was the only time I ever went to confession. Because the tradition was you went to confession on Saturday, and then you couldn't get up and take the cookie unless you went on Saturday.
Huh. Now, it seems strange that they didn't explain to you for whatever reason, but why do you imagine they didn't explain who Jesus was, what he did, what's the significance of the atonement, and what communion stands for?
I mean, they did. I mean, you had to go through some classes each Saturday, but again, I just don't think that I got it.
Okay.
I don't think I really understood what its true meaning was. It was just like, you know, going through driver's ed class. You had to go through the classes before you could get your license. Okay. So then I went to, you know, I made my confession. And then one thing I noticed is that whenever we went to church, my dad never got up to take communion because he never went on Saturday to make his confession.
So he couldn't have communion.
Right, so he couldn't. And I never made my confession ever again because my dad didn't want to drive me to church every Saturday.
Wow.
So he wasn't going, so I never went. So I made one confession in my entire life, and that was it.
Wow. Now, in your book and in your seminar, you talk about the day when your dad announced that was the end of going to church.
Right. That was a real, real surprise. That he simply said, we're not going to church anymore. And at the time, I was really thrilled because I really didn't like going anyway. And I asked him why, and he said, you know, he basically outlined some things. Well, you know, they're having people on the pulpit that are not ordained that are speaking. They're having these folk masses, which he just couldn't stand. I think it was at that time in the 60s when the rock and roll movement was really moving forward, and he viewed that as the church accommodating the culture of having what he called rock and roll in the church. Although it was just, you know, folk guitars and singing was all it amounted to. But I think, looking back, my dad passed away 5 years ago. I think the other thing for my dad was I don't think he got much out of the service either. I think he had done his duty to give the kids some religion. I was the last of the three kids. He brought me to at least age 10 with some basic understanding of the faith, and I think that he just didn't want to go anymore. I think he was just disillusioned to the direction of the church. I don't know how strong of a faith my dad really had, but he was done.
Okay.
Now, what happened prior to that, I didn't find this out until really years later, was that two nuns came over to question why I had not made my confirmation yet. And I believe at that time you had to make it when you were about 14 or 15. And I remember my friends all had their Catholic name and questioned why I didn't. Well, I never went. And so there was a big argument that ensued. And what I understand later is that my dad threw the nuns out of the house because I guess he told them off of what he thought of the Catholic Church and the direction of the Catholic Church. And it was at that time that he vowed never to go back to church again. And he didn't. Other than any time we may have gone to a wedding, he never went back. And even when he passed away on his deathbed, when he was given the option of being given his last rites, he refused.
Wow. So then having kind of got delivered from church, it really didn't get you away from people bringing up religion or telling you about hell and things like that, right?
Right. I mean, there was always people that would question my beliefs, and my stock answer is kind of a joke was that, well, I'm a Catholic agnostic. You know, in other words, I was born Catholic, but I really don't have any idea who's right and who's wrong. And who can know what's right and what's wrong? Who are you to tell me how to live? It's my view of most Christians were these narrow-minded, judgmental people telling people how they should live. And who are they to tell me or tell anyone how they should live?
Okay.
So with such a negative impression of what I thought of Christians, why would I want to join with them or be one of them?
Yeah, and then you also recount an incident where you ran into these priests that were drunk and weird.
Yeah, that was a really disturbing event. It was a good friend of mine, and he and his family were best friends with a group of priests. They were very Catholic. They were very devout. And I went to some activity at his home, and then we were going to go out to a restaurant with two other priests. And we sat at the table, and when I got there, the priests were drinking alcohol. Now, I was kind of surprised at that they would be drinking, but you know, I didn't know, is that supposed to be good or not? But it did kind of surprise me. So I was sitting one of the next to the priest, and he put his hand on my shoulder a couple of times, kind of, you know, slap happy, you know, making a joke here and there. And sometimes he'd just keep his hand on my shoulder. And, well, I didn't know what to think. He was a priest, so I didn't think anything negative at the moment. But he kept on dropping his hand down to the lower part of my back. And I started to get really uncomfortable. I'm like, you know, why is he, like, touching me? You know, what's going on here? And then he lifted up the bottom of my shirt and started stroking the lower part of my back with his hand. And I just got really upset. I jumped up from the table and I grabbed my other friend, Al. That was my friend Al and this other guy. And I said, oh, we got to get out of here. And he goes, what's wrong? And I said, well, my friend's priest is putting his hand down the back of my shirt, down the back of my pants. And he says, oh, don't tell him. They'll be really upset. You know, he won't want to hear that. And at that moment, my friend comes up and he goes, what are you guys doing? Why'd you all of a sudden jump up? And I didn't hold back. I told him exactly what happened. And he just totally dismissed it. He didn't believe me. He thought I was imagining things. But it was at that moment that I said, Al, we got to go.
So you'd had a whole string of experiences that would turn you off to Christianity.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know what to think of that whole incident. I mean, now in retrospect, with all the things that we've seen go on in the Catholic Church, it does give me a little insight. But at that moment, you know, I was only 15, maybe 16, and no man had ever done anything like that. And especially coming from a priest, I was just completely disillusioned. I didn't know what to think of that.
Okay, well, I think you mentioned in your book that already at a fairly young age you started dabbling in occult.
Yeah, I thought that was the most interesting topic to get into. And, you know, it was on television all the time. You see it in many shows where you have the tarot card reader and they're telling about the future. And at that time, a lot of the shows that were on that I thought were really interesting were like The Sixth Sense and all of these type of extrasensory perception shows. So it was very attractive. So I thought, boy, it'd be really cool to get a deck of tarot cards. So my mom bought me a deck of tarot cards. I think she just looked at it as, you know, something fun. So I started doing tarot card readings in high school. I used to have them in the cafeteria. I'd do readings for people. Most people just thought it was a really cool thing to do. And I, you know, when you're that age, you kind of want to get people's attention. Mm-hmm. And that brought me attention. And of course, girls thought it was cool, so I wanted that too. But I do recall there was one particular woman that really gave me a hard time about it. I mean, really saying, you know, this is satanic stuff. You know, this is really bad. You know, you keep on doing this stuff, you know, you're going to have all sorts of problems with demons and things like that. And I thought she was a complete lunatic. I dismissed everything she said.
You suppose maybe she came from some more of a Christian home where they actually knew about these things or what?
I don't really know. Okay. I don't know what her background was. I mean, I knew her as a person that was really religious. In mm-hmm. other words, she may have been a true believer, but to me, anyone that was really that would actually espouse their view was religious, in which they'd tell you how to live. And I just dismissed her. I thought she was a kook. And, you know, there's no harm going on here. Everybody likes it. What's the big deal?
So your general impression of Christians was?
Judgmental, narrow-minded, boring, led a very restrictive life. I don't know, not anybody I would ever want to hang out with.
Okay, so then as you got through school, what'd you do with yourself?
Well, my brother was in the Air Force. he actually was ended up being in the Air Force for 20 years, and he was an Air Force recruiter. So he ended up recruiting me. You know, I helped with his goal. And my sister had been in the Air Force Reserve. My grandfather was in both the Army and the Marines in World War I, World War II. My dad was in the Navy. So we had a pretty big tradition about the military in our family. So my family didn't have any money for college, so the only way I would ever be able to afford it is if I went into the Air Force, and at that time they still had the GI Bill. They actually ended that generous benefits of the GI Bill in 1977, and I entered the Air Force in 1976. So I graduated high school in 76, and 2 weeks later I went into the Air Force.
Okay, and in the Air Force, did you continue to run into religious people?
Yeah. After basic training, I went to Biloxi, Mississippi for my training for my job, which was kind of a version of air traffic control for air defense. I met a Christian guy. He was actually a pastor or training to be a pastor, or he was going to be a pastor in the Air Force. And, you know, he kind of fulfilled all the stereotypes for me, very conservative, always preaching the Bible at everybody. And I share this in the book that there was a guy that was probably the most anti-Christian guy you'd ever meet. He was really a big guy, swore continuously, drank a lot. You know, he was just one of those guys. And he needled that pastor constantly, just making fun of him, you know, because that pastor was engaged and he was really making very inappropriate jokes in front of him about sex. And he was doing it just to tweak him. And I hate to admit this, but I kind of enjoyed the tweaking myself. Because I always looked at them as, you know, these conservative people that aren't allowed to have fun, and they have all these restrictions on their life. And so he was just really mean to him on a constant basis. Out of that, there was a small good impression that I got, was that that pastor finally at some point took him aside. I think they went out one evening, and the rest of the time I was in training, he never gave that guy, the pastor, a hard time again.
Wow.
So I think whatever he did, he must have explained the gospel to him, or he must have explained his position, and it must have been in such a way that it must have shamed him, because from that point forward, he never made fun of him again. Now, before I left for that training, he really did challenge me about whether I believed in Jesus, and he really kind of scared me about it, that if I didn't follow Jesus, then I would go to hell. And I went back to my room, and I really did get down on my knees, and I prayed that I would be saved. But the next morning, I didn't feel any different. And I thought, oh, well, I was just paranoid, scared. But
so he convinced you that you need to ask God to forgive you?
Yeah. Yeah, he really scared me. But it didn't seem...
It wasn't the same as you really weren't converted.
No. I think I just did it out of fear, not out of wanting a genuine relationship, because all that he shared with me is I either did what he did, followed what he was saying, or I was destined for hell.
And this guy was very, very rigid in his understanding.
Yeah. I mean, but again, I didn't know the questions to ask to see what rigidity meant.
Yeah.
I knew so little about the Christian faith. All that it was probably the TV version of it.
Well, you know, I remember, you know, similar things, because I grew up, I'm 5 years older than you, it sounds like, or no, 7 years older, because I graduated in 69. But I grew up in a liberal church, and I knew the facts that we were supposed to believe. We had to repeat it back when you're 12 years old to join a church.
Right.
But the leadership of my church had gone liberal, and they didn't even believe, some of the pastors didn't even believe in the resurrection of Christ, okay? But I remember times, I remember one in particular before I became a Christian. I was driving my car in an ice storm. I was trying to get back from Iowa State University to our farm near Sheldon, Iowa. It's 200 miles. And it was just glare ice the whole way. And I had to get back because it was Thanksgiving break and they were closing up the dorm and I had to go home. Okay. And this is back when the bias ply tires were terrible. They wouldn't grab onto anything. And literally the car was being blown sideways toward the ditch.
Jeez.
The wind was blowing. And I remember praying, God forgive me for all the sins I ever committed. Amen.
There's a commitment.
Yeah. White knuckles on the steering wheel. When I got home without dying in the car, I forgot all about it.
That's probably an equivalent experience. It didn't last. The next day, I didn't feel like it. And I think in the back of my mind, I still had the impression of, I can't be a Christian. I'm too lousy of a person. I can't have that restrictive lifestyle like he does. I just can't imagine living that way.
I wonder if that isn't just sort of what we're like by default when we're blinded by Satan. You know, because I remember myself when Diane, who's now my wife, she got saved before I did, and we were engaged at the time. And that's all I could understand was, why are they wearing granny dresses? I mean, this was back when the miniskirts were in style.
Yep.
And why they can't do this and they can't do that. And really, I finally decided, I can't deal with this. I don't think I can live up to this. I might as well just go to the bar when I turned 21, which I hadn't turned 21 yet.
Oh, I vilified people like those. I hate to admit it, but I was really mean to Christians like that.
Well, I was a blasphemer myself, especially when I started being confronted with my own sin. That was my defense mechanism to put them off.
Yeah.
So one time you told me something, Brian, I think it's really true. It really takes a work of grace to take the scales off somebody's eyes.
Absolutely.
Because when you hear about hell and you're not saved, and I'm not saying we shouldn't preach on it.
Right,
because
right.
The truth is the truth, and people need to run from God's
wrath. They need
wrath.
To know that there's consequences.
Yeah, there is a real hell, and there's a real wrath of God against sin. They need to understand it. But it's when you're blinded, it's like you can't see it. It's like you just don't believe it really is going to be that way.
No.
And somehow, before I was converted, I was 20 when I became a Christian. In my mind, if I go out and I don't mooch off of the state and become a bum.
Yeah, I'm a good guy.
Yeah, right. I'm going to pay my own bills and, you know, take care of my taxes and do what I'm supposed to do. And then if there is a God, he's going to understand.
Right. Right. He's an understanding, loving God. Hey, I haven't, you know, I'm not a bad person. I haven't, you know, murdered anybody. And so I'm, you know, I haven't been arrested for anything. So I can't believe that God would condemn me.
I think that that's how, when we're lost, that's how we feel because of Satan's blinding of eyes. Like Paul said, if our gospel's hid, it's hid to those who are lost.
Right.
In whose case, the God of this world has blinded their minds unless they see the light of Christ.
Correct.
And so I remember even after I was convinced that God created the world out of nothing, before I was converted, studying chemical engineering, I saw the intricacies of the molecular biology of the body had to have been created by an intelligent God.
Yeah.
But even after that experience, I spent, you know, one of my drives back from Ames to Sheldon thinking about God. And I came to the conclusion that there probably was a God, but I couldn't figure out why he cared what I did. Why was it hurting God if I go party?
And I never saw the conflict between evolution and believing in God. I always believed in God. I just thought that I didn't understand that they were really in direct opposition to each other. Those two beliefs cannot be compromised. So to me, you know, I'd hear the thing about the scientific argument. I go, yeah, we were a product of evolution, but I think God started it all.
Oh. Yeah, I came to reject evolution before I became a Christian, but my problem was whether I'd submit to God as the Lord of my life.
Right.
Because I felt like, why should he care what I do?
Yeah.
So I was still a sinner in rebellion against God.
Yep.
So as were you. And
very much.
So you ended up in Duluth, was it?
Yep, I got stationed in Duluth. You know, they had just about the worst weather I've ever experienced in my life. You know, growing up in New York, you get a lot of snow, but in upper Minnesota, it's just the winter is just from, it just goes from, you know, October through April. And maybe you'd get about one day out of three where it would be sunny. Oh, I didn't like being up in Duluth.
And no offense to anybody listening in Duluth.
Yeah, there goes my readership in Duluth. It was a very pretty town, but you know, I was 19. I was on my own for the first time. The one thing I will say positive about the Air Force or being in the military, you're on your own, but not completely. You have an income, you have a place to stay, and people to look out for you. It gives you a chance to grow up. But and away from your parents, but in a controlled atmosphere, And I really value that experience, even though I ended up not really liking the military after 4 years. I got out of my 4 years. But really, I thought that was a great experience for me. You know, just being at home my whole life, never really gotten out on my own.
Sure.
So it was a valuable experience.
Now, where were you? You said in your book that you started doing LSD.
Yeah. One of the turning points in my life was when I really had the opportunity to be in my first rock band. And we were very fortunate that we had an unusual shift where we worked 4 days on and 4 days off. So I could actually be in a band part-time while I was in the Air Force.
Wow.
So it was a lot of fun, and I got to be a bass player, and we played around the upper, you know, parts of Wisconsin and Minnesota, and played on, you know, off weekends or whatever. And through that, I started smoking a lot of marijuana, and I jumped to LSD. And my friend said to me before I took that LSD experience that it would change the way I viewed things, you know, forever. And he was really correct. I didn't realize how right he was, because LSD puts you in an altered state of consciousness and you view things differently. It is almost like I equate it to be almost like coming to the planet Earth for the very first time and seeing human beings. You know, we become accustomed to seeing things and accustomed to people's faces and how they look, and we tend not to see the oddities of them. But in an altered state of consciousness, you look at things through a very fresh eye, so fresh that a lot of things that are seem ugly. The one thing you never want to do when you're on LSD is to look in a mirror, because you see every flaw. It's a very disturbing experience. But I actually had little or no negative experiences from it. I thought it was just fun. I knew the weird things I was seeing and the colors weren't really there, so I just enjoyed the experience.
Now, do you think that doing LSD maybe opened you up to future dabbling in the occult even more, or getting fully into it?
It really did, because what it told me was there was another plane of consciousness, was the way I put it. There was another way of viewing things. There was much more than this cold, natural life that I saw with my own eyes, that there was a supernatural existence and that I had tapped into it, and that there was something else out there than what I could see in front of my hand every day. So it did open a doorway for me that there was another way to view life. Maybe perhaps you can almost equate it to a lot of people who look at that movie, The Matrix, in the same way.
Well, I was just going to ask about that, because as you were describing this, it made me wonder about something. We now live in an era in which it's called postmodern.
Yep.
Where people don't believe you can know what concrete reality is all about.
Correct.
That altered states of consciousness might actually be a good thing.
Yeah.
I wonder if all the LSD that was prevalent in the 70s didn't sort of set us up for that.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think so. LSD changes your perception. It is unlike any other drug. Now, I did a little cocaine, not a whole lot. It was way too expensive back then, so I just didn't do it. I never went to heroin. It was mostly, I think, marijuana, LSD. I think I did speed once or twice, but I didn't really like it. So it was pretty limited. But LSD is different. Cocaine makes you feel nice. Marijuana makes you feel nice. But LSD really changes your perception of reality. It is a very unique experience.
And I wonder just how much damage is done to our whole culture because of it.
I think the equation comes down to the view of the Matrix. You take this pill, just like in the movie, and what happens is you're ripped away from the Matrix, which is, in the movie, a computer-generated, simulated world. And all of a sudden, that simulated world is torn apart from you, and now you see the cold reality of what things really look like.
Wow.
You know, the Matrix is really a view of Hinduism, that all around us is Maya, that it is illusion. And the goal is to tear away that illusion.
Well, now people have learned safer ways to do this. They get into altered states by mystical experiences without using the drugs.
Right. That's true. And that's what really where all these experiences I had early in life now apply when I'm sharing with people about the problems with contemplative prayer. Because even Merton equated LSD with contemplative prayer. Because he said, you know, isn't it a shame all these kids are going into LSD to get this experience when we have something in the church that nobody even knows about? And he must have known that LSD put you in an altered state of consciousness.
Absolutely.
And so did contemplative prayer. How else – why would he use that as an analogy unless he knew the two were equivalent?
That reminds me, in 1986, we had Dave Hunt speak at our church on his, at the time, relatively new book, The Seduction of Christianity, and he was talking about something similar. He was talking to a lady about Christianity, and her son had gotten off into one of these kind of mind science cults or some sort of a altered state of consciousness type religion. And the lady says to Dave Hunt, well, at least my son isn't taking drugs. And Dave said to her, drugs is the kindergarten. What he's in now is the graduate school.
Yeah, he's right. He is right. Because now we think that we are totally cognizant and that this is a practice that's ordained by God. You know, I just got an email just the night before where people are saying to me, well, I really like to fight this movement. Do you have any famous people that are against it? You know, in other words, we totally go based upon reputations of people to make our decisions rather than looking to the Word of God.
Yeah, that's too bad. As we kind of wrap up this section here, you ended up in Alaska.
Yes.
And talked to a priest there that had no answers, right?
No. My first sergeant said, Brian, I got down on your profile that you're Catholic. And again, I made the Catholic agnostic joke. And he goes, I don't care about your agnosticism. You're a Catholic. There's a priest here. You're supposed to go at 900 hours. Boom. There was no choices back then. And I went in, and I was very rude. And I basically laid out a case against Christianity. And what saddened me to this day was that he didn't counter my arguments with anything. I just told him, I just don't believe that you guys have the answer and everybody else is wrong. And most of his responses were like, well, you just got to believe.
Fideism, just believe for the sake of belief. Or
yeah,
having a reason.
And I afterward, I kind of felt bad because I thought, geez, I picked on a priest. You know, I was really kind of mean and rude. But what hung with me is that I won the argument, and I shouldn't have. I won way too many arguments with Christians, and I should have lost many of them.
Wow. Well, next week we'll talk about how you ended up in Minneapolis, where you are now.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, Brian finally ran into somebody he couldn't win the argument with, and the Lord had another plan for him, which was to serve God, which he's doing today. And I thank God for Brian, and I enjoy working with him in the ministry. This is Critical Issues Commentary, the radio ministry of Twin City Fellowship. I'm Pastor Bob DeWay, and I've been speaking today with Brian Flynn, the author of the book Running Against the Wind. Next week, we'll pick up with this story, and be sure to tune in. For Critical Issues Commentary, this is Bob DeWay.
And I'm Brian Flynn.
See you next week.